From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. Capturing the bone-crushing sounds and sights of NFL football. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from NFL Films President Steve Sable on how his film crew set up to make sure they don't miss the big plays. Also, Indian writer Arundhati Roy. Her first novel, The God of Small Things, has become an international bestseller. Last month, she received Britain's highest literary award, the prestigious Booker Prize. And South African satirist Peter Dirk Ace. He'll be bringing his humor to America. His new show, You Ain't See Nothing Yet, opens in Brooklyn this month. And film critic John Powers reviews The Wings of the Dove, the new film starring Helena Bonham Carter. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has ordered a second aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf as tensions heighten with Iraq over Baghdad's expulsion of United Nations weapons inspectors. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
President Clinton told reporters today that he had ordered the U.S. aircraft carrier George Washington to the Persian Gulf. He said it was the appropriate response to Iraq's continued defiance of U.N. weapons inspections. The president said that the world has got to understand that this is not just a replay of the Gulf War. He said this is about the danger of biological and chemical weapons, what the president calls the security threat of the 21st century.
We have to steel ourselves and be determined that the will of the international community, expressed in the United Nations Security Council resolutions, will have to prevail.
The White House says it's continuing to study all its options in the crisis, diplomatic and military. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Israel says it will strike back at any new Iraqi aggression. During the Gulf War, Iraq attacked Israel with Scud missiles, but Israel complied with U.S. requests and did not retaliate. The Israelis say now they will respond differently. Today's strong rhetoric comes as the United States tries to build international support against Iraqi action. Such a coalition was formed during the Gulf War in 1991. Observers say it may be more difficult now to form such a coalition because of the deadlock in the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Former Miami Mayor Xavier Suarez was returned to office in a runoff election that was shadowed by an investigation into absentee ballot fraud. NPR Cheryl Duvall reports from Miami.
Xavier Suarez, who was mayor of Miami from 1985 to 1993, won back the seat from incumbent Joe Carollo by a margin of more than 6 percentage points. Suarez had criticized the handling of Miami's financial crisis earlier this year. He'd also blasted a state investigation of absentee ballots that gave him a big boost in last week's election. As mayor, Suarez will have more clout than during his previous terms because Miami this year gave the office more executive powers. The name of Dade County, which includes the city, is also about to change. Voters have chosen to hyphenate the 161-year-old county, calling it Miami-Dade from now on. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
An attorney for euthanasia supporter Dr. Jack Kevorkian says a sympathetic priest allowed Kevorkian to assist in a suicide at a church. 74-year-old Nadia Folds of New York reportedly had liver cancer when she committed suicide. Kevorkian later took her body to a hospital. Kevorkian's assisted suicide work has been condemned and denounced by Roman Catholic officials. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down a quarter of a point at 7,488. Trading is active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is trading higher in a narrow range. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors continue to debate the likely fallout from economic difficulties in the Pacific Rim. Overnight, the Japanese stock market lost more than 2%. The market is also being buffeted by the report on retail sales, which showed unexpected weakness during October. On one hand, it's a positive for continued low inflation, but the implied slowdown in consumer spending is a negative for corporate earnings. The day's other major piece of economic news confirms there is little inflation at the wholesale level. Producer prices barely rose last month. Meantime, the price of gold fell to a 12-and-a-half-year low on persistent speculation of increased selling from the world's central banks. I'm Doug Krisner.
It appears last month's violent swings on the stock market slowed the stampede into mutual funds. A trade group says investors poured more than 18% less new money into stock funds in October than they did in September. However, last month was still one of the biggest for inflows this year. Shares of MGM had less than a dazzling debut on Wall Street today. The movie studio's new stock fell in early going, but rebounded to close at 21, up a dollar from the opening price. Some analysts say investors wonder whether upcoming MGM films will make money. Westinghouse is selling its non-nuclear power generation business to a German competitor for $1.5 billion. And it says it will sell its remaining industrial businesses and become solely a broadcast company. It will be called CBS Corporation. Again, on Wall Street, the Dow's down a quarter point. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. NFL films were the first filmmakers to mic football players and coaches and have changed the way that fans have viewed and enjoyed the sport. The look and feel of an NFL film is unmistakable. It's reverential and larger than life, and its mission is clear: to glorify the game. In its 35-year history, NFL Films has shot thousands of football games, boasts a sports library with more than 20 million feet of film, produced more than 3,000 TV shows and specials, and won 69 Emmys. The football season is in high gear, and on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Steve Sable, the president of NFL Films and son of the founder. He played football through high school and college before his father hired him. I asked Steve Sable, when filming a game today, how big a crew he sends on the field.
The best way to explain that would be that live television usually uses between 12 and 15 cameras at a game. We use three. And everybody's, oh, see, now even you're surprised,
you
your
look.
Eyebrows, yeah, that's right. We have three cameramen, a top man who's called a tree. He's rooted in the position. He gives you your basic top coverage. Then we have a mole, and he's a handheld mobile cameraman that shoots a camera from the ground with a focal length lens of 12 to 240, which is a fairly dramatic zoom. And once in a while, he's connected to a sound man. Then we have a third cameraman who's called a weasel, and it's his job to shoot everything but the action. Now, when I was a cameraman, I was a weasel, and I shot the first 15 Super Bowls, and I never saw a play. But because I was always shooting the coaches or the fans or some of the little details. So those are really the three elements, the three types of cinematographers that we have at every game.
And is that the hierarchy with the weasel at the bottom?
Well, I think that when people think of NFL films, they think of the action shots. But being a former weasel myself, I think that that actually the weasels are part of the storytellers. I was an art major in college. And I remember studying Paul Cézanne, who once said that all art is selected detail. And when we started NFL Films, I always felt there should be a cameraman that just has an eye for the details, the cleat marks in the mud, the way the sun comes through the portals of a stadium, the silhouette of a coach walking against the sunlit stands. And that was an element that I, when I started to shoot, that I focused on. So I think a weasel really is important, although certainly not as important as the guys that shoot the action.
Are there certain cameramen you think that specialize in a certain kind of shot? Is there a guy that kind of has a weasel personality that you know is just going to get those details and some of that background stuff?
Well, when you think of NFL films, you think, well, we're specialized in football. But within that specialization, there are specialists. There are cameramen that specialize just in shooting a telephoto lens, just shooting the trademark, our ball spiraling slowly through the air. A weasel is strictly an eye. A weasel doesn't have to know anything about football.
Really?
But nothing. I mean, at Super Bowls, we usually have guest weasels. A couple years ago, we had Haskell Wexler, the Academy Award-winning director and DP for Medium Cool, and he weaseled for us.
What did he get for you?
He got a couple. It was a lot out of focus, believe it or not. But but he did, as you know, as you'd expect, a cameraman of his talent. He came up with a few shots and angles that none of us who were so immersed in the game would have ever thought of.
You say that your mission is
to act as storytellers, to tell the story of football or the story of a particular kind of a game. I think the language of football often is about doing battle. Is that what you think the story of football is? About
warfare?
Well,
I think it's a very militaristic sport, and I think that's part of the popularity. I think it's, you know, they always say that cultures can be defined by their games. When you look at the Greeks, they had the Olympics. The Romans had the Colosseum, and I think in a certain way now that you can look at our society and compare it maybe to the Middle Ages when the whole towns were built around cathedrals and churches. And now when you look at towns are these giant stadiums that in many ways, maybe a little bit of a stretch that you could say that this is sort of a religion now with these giant stadiums and the congregation gathers every Sunday to worship at the or certainly to be entertained or to draw some sort of emotional sustenance from the sport.
But do you think that you have, and the folks at NFL Films, have really then contributed to the development of the passion for this game?
I think we have, but in sort of a naive and innocent way. I think when we started, it was four or five of us, and it was just at the time a bunch of young guys who loved to make movies and who loved pro football and wanted to convey that love of the game to our audience. Now people look back at what we did and say, boy, what a, you know, you guys were great marketers. You were great packagers. You were great promoters. What a great advertising arm. But we never thought that way. And I still never think of NFL Films as promoting or advertising or marketing. We're just passionate observers of a sport that we all love. And in the beginning, we were allowed to do that. I mean, Pete Rozelle, who was a commissioner, never told me or my father, I want you to do this. I want you to do that. In fact, and this shows you how prescient he was as a commissioner. He kept us separate from New York. He kept us, we were from Philadelphia, and he let the company grow and evolve in Philadelphia. And he always told me and my father that it was good that way because we would be able to take risks, that we would be separated from the corporate culture and the league, and that we could develop as filmmakers. Because I always felt that it was important to be able to take the risk, to try new things. And if you have to go through a series of committees, that never happens.
And yet I know you're aware of some of the criticism that NFL Films provides a kind of propaganda for the game, because it does glorify the game.
Sure,
there's
does.
No question about
but,
it.
But in that respect, I go back to my background as an art major, that there were certain artists that depicted things in a certain way. And if you wanted to show the horrors of war, Goya would be a good person to paint. If you wanted the glory of war, it could be Jericho or Delacroix that would paint those paintings. So we're sort of artists, but this is just our way of interpreting the way we feel about the sport. Now, if someone says, well, that's you're glorifying it. Well, I love the game, and that's the way I feel about it.
Let's talk a little bit about your father, who founded NFL Films. And my understanding is that he was the home photographer.
Oh, yeah.
If you were doing something, your dad was taking a picture of it.
Well, my dad, first of all, to me, I don't know how many sons can look at their father and say that they were their hero, their father, the funniest person they ever met, the best man at my wedding, my boss. But all of those things pertain to my father. And NFL Films really began with a wedding present. My dad was an overcoat salesman in the 1950s. And when he was married, as a wedding present, my grandmother gave him a little wind-up Bell & Howell movie camera. And everything that I did as his first and only son, there was my dad filming my first haircut, my first pony ride, my first birthday, my first football game. And every football game that I played in from the time I was in fourth grade to the time I graduated Haverford School in 1960, there was my dad on top of the chemistry building at Haverford School on Lancaster Avenue filming me playing football. So by the time I'd been accepted at Colorado College, he'd gotten good enough at filming football that he felt that he was going to make this his profession. He dropped out of the overcoat business and took the money that he'd saved up and started a film company. And in 1961, the film rights for the NFL championship game had sold to an independent film producer for $1,500. And my dad decided that he would, next year, he was going to get the rights no matter what. So he figured he would double the bid. He went to New York when they had the auction for the film rights. This is for the championship game. He doubled the bid, $3,000, won the bid. And Pete Rozelle opening up my dad's bid, usually in the past, they'd make that, you know, they'd say, well, this bid has been won by Ed Sable, and he's going to be doing the championship game. But Pete Rozelle opened it up, saw the amount of money, and then quickly read over my dad's resume and became a little concerned when he saw that his only experience filming football was filming his 14-year-old son. So he just said, Ed, I'd like to talk to you for a second. And then they went out to lunch. And after several drinks at 21, my dad and Pete came to an agreement that Pete would let my dad film the 62 championship game. And that's when I got the phone call, and that's when Dad hired Bob Ryan and Art Spieler and Walter Dumbrow, the three people in the company, and that's how well, it was actually Blair Motion Pictures then. It was named after my sister. We didn't become NFL Films until 3 years later.
So your dad was a good salesman.
He had a tremendous entrepreneurial vision, and he kept NFL Films alive for the first 4 or 5 years. A lot of people think that our style came out of our first film. It didn't. It wasn't until 1966 when we did a film called They Call It Pro Football, and we used a narrator by the name of John Facenda, that was the Citizen Kane of sports movies there. That's when we made the break from what had been done in the past to what I think has influenced all sports movie making today.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today is Steve Sable, and he's president of NFL Films. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Steve Sable today, and he's president of NFL Films. Let's talk a little bit about the music, because certainly that's a very important ingredient in the making of and certainly the viewing of NFL Films, again, to kind of heighten the drama and, mm-hmm. and the experience. What is it about that song, What Do We Do With a Drunken Sailor?
I mean,
hasn't that appeared several times in an NFL film?
That's almost our theme song. And when we started in the 60s, I felt it would be very important to develop a musical style that would be unique to football. And it wasn't the John Philip Sousa Oompa Oompa music, but something that was movie music that told a story. And as a kid going to Blue Mountain Camp in the Poconos, every Friday night we'd have these campfires and we'd sing these songs. And one of the songs was, you know, What Do You Do With a Drunken Sailor? But it was one of those hummable things that you'd hum next day when you were playing softball or you're out canoeing. You'd be going da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So when we started NFL Films, that's the kind of music I wanted, but not done with just a single instrument, but with a 50 or 60-piece orchestra. So we found this composer by the name of Sam Spence, and he was working in California at the time, and we hit it off great. And I would hum some of these melodies to him, sometimes over the phone,
melodies.
Camp songs, and they would come back with 50 strings and flugelhorns and French horns and these incredible arrangements. And it also, like John Facenda, helped create a unique style or became a signature of our movies.
So it's possible then to watch some NFL films and hunt for some camp songs that
embedded
in the soundtrack there.
Oh, sure. There are a lot of
kind of like Where's Waldo version of that.
But, you know, when you think of how important music is in our lives, you get married to music, you get buried to music, you go to war to music, people make love to music. So, and I remember watching Gone with the Wind that was 222 minutes long, and there's like only 19 or 20 minutes in that whole movie that doesn't have music. And football is a sport that people associate with music, and it's so important to help build the drama and tell the story.
So is that how you work with a composer, which is literally humming in some songs over a telephone
and
then they
how
go
we
from
did
there?
It. That's how we did it for the first 15 years. Now we have two composers, full-time composers, Tom Hedden and Dave Robidoux, who work in right in our NFL films and do all the composing right there on a synthesizer. And then we take their outlines on a synthesizer, and then it goes over to the London Symphonic Orchestra, and we do it over there.
Well, if you have all these archives, all these movies in your archives, how would you say football has changed? How is it different today?
Well, I think the stadiums have changed the game, because especially the domes. They've sterilized the game. You look at a game in the Kingdome or in the Astrodome, which fortunately is not going to be used anymore, and it looks like inside of an aquarium. The players look like little freeze-dried peas. It doesn't have the sense of grandeur and the mythic quality of the passing of the seasons that you see in the open-air stadiums. I think that's changed. I think the players have changed in a way in that there's a sense of entitlement now among the players that all this they're entitled to. Where players in the 50s and 60s, there was a sense of gratitude that they were privileged to be part of this, to be part of the league, to play a game like football. Now there's more of a sense of, like I said, well, they're owed this. There's this entitlement. So there is a difference, a little different, I think, feeling. And that goes back to colleges, too, because the athletes today in colleges are incredibly pampered. And mm-hmm. And that's one thing that people don't realize when you go to you see how a football team operates. I mean, these players are every hour of the day is regimented. You eat breakfast. This is when you get dressed. Now you get in your car, you go to the bus, you go to the stadium, you're back from the stadium, we have a meeting. I mean, it's almost very similar to still being in school. So there's a certain immaturity there. And a lot of the players, once they get out of the game, are suddenly they have this incredible free, undisciplined time, and it's hard to make that adjustment.
In this documentary about NFL films, I think one of the cameramen says that as soon as you put a camera on a fan, their IQ drops about 20 points.
Yeah, it's true, and it's that was a problem that began, I think, and I'd blame Monday Night Football for that, because I remember being a weasel as a cameraman. You could go up and you could shoot a player or a fan, and they would never look at the camera. They'd be involved in the game. Then, I believe it was in 1972, it was a Jets game, that one of the Jets, I believe it was Don Maynard, scored a touchdown and came to the sidelines. And the Monday night cameraman came over to him and couldn't get a face shot of him. So the director, Chet Forty, said, tap him on his shoulder and tell him he's on camera. So the cameraman did that. Don Maynard turned around, looked at the camera, and I guess didn't know what to do, and he said, hi, Mom. And that was the beginning of the hi, Mom syndrome, which fans saw, players saw, and from then on, it was terrible for us because we couldn't get a good documentary shot because fans thought we were they couldn't tell the difference between two cameras.
Right.
They'd see us, and instead of cheering or a player talking about the game, they'd look at us and say, hi, Mom, or, you know, what they do now. And those shots are worthless to us. We can't use them. So that was one of the bigger problems we had during the 70s and the 80s. Now, like I said, fans are part of the spectacle themselves.
Steve Sable is president of NFL Films. The Wings of the Dove is the new movie based on the turn-of-the-century novel by Henry James, the latest film adapted from a James story. Portrait of a Lady came out last Christmas, and Washington Square opened this fall. The Wings of the Dove stars Helena Bonham Carter as Kate. Film critic John Powers has a review.
Back during Hollywood's E.M. Forster boom, some friends and I were trying to guess which great writers were the next to be hot. When someone mentioned Henry James, I scoffed. Too arcane. So here comes The Wings of the Dove, the third James adaptation in the last year. It's a sumptuous and psychologically gripping new movie by Ian Softley, the English director best known for Backbeat, which was about those arcane fellows, the Beatles. Like so many classic stories, The Wings of the Dove is about marriage and money. Helena Bonham Carter stars as Kate Croy, a guileful young beauty who lives in London with a wealthy aunt who wants to marry her off to someone rich. Kate's already in love with Merton Densher, a penniless left-wing journalist played by Linus Roach. But she lacks the courage to marry someone poor. So she cooks up a conspiracy to pair Densher off with her friend Millie Thiel, a lovely, good-hearted American played by Alison Elliott. Millie's a supremely rich heiress with a terminal disease and the desire to taste of the world before she dies. The three go off to Venice together, but Kate's plans boomerang. And by the end, Kate and Densher are never quite sure who's betraying whom, or whether they're betraying themselves. Such complexity is pure James, and it's set up from the earliest scenes, as when Kate and Densher are in his room and talk about getting married.
What if I didn't let you leave tonight? What would happen?
I'd be penniless, cast out of society, and I'd be stuck with you.
Good. Well, we'll open a bottle of something, and in the morning, everyone will know about us.
I'm not good at being impulsive.
Well, maybe if you just fell asleep and I didn't wake you up.
I won't fall asleep. One day you'll get tired of me.
I think it'll be the other way around.
No, it won't.
T.S. Eliot once wrote that James had a mind so fine that no idea could violate it. And if you've read The Wings of the Dove, you know it couldn't be much less cinematic. James doesn't write dramatic scenes. His sentences coil endlessly like boa constrictors, and his characters speak dialogue that ranges from the elliptical to the cryptic. The novel is so refined that it seems to have been spun from mist, which isn't to say that it's vaporous. On the contrary, Wings of the Dove is about big things, sexual desire and social class, duplicity and self-deception. Screenwriter Hossein Amini has brilliantly stripped away the Jamesian convolution to produce a script that's lively, explicit, and emotionally dangerous. In short, thoroughly modern. He and director Softly have updated the story to 1910, which lets them bring in automobiles and an exhibition of racy paintings by Klimt. And though Henry James is somewhere twirling in his grave, they've built the film into a climactic sex scene in which the nudity is thematically and psychologically justified. The filmmakers may have simplified James' tale, but the characters' motivations remain as richly mysterious as the Venice where they ultimately play themselves out. Linus Roach, who played the title role in Priest, has the good looks of a better-read Kevin Costner and a knack for playing men of high principle and uneasy virtue. Virile and suggestible, he captures Densher's rage, bafflement, and disillusionment at being snared by Kate's scheme and by Millie's ardor for life. As Millie, Alison Elliott is good but a bit wan, which is as much Henry James' fault as hers. He always sentimentalized innocent young American women. He makes them too good, and Elliott gives Millie sweetness but not depth. Luckily, Kate Croy has more than enough depth for any two movies. Ever since she stopped playing nice girls, Helena Bonham Carter has flowered as an actress. As Kate, she's a vision of alluring but ambiguous beauty, a black rose, all bountiful hair and flashing dark eyes. Bonham Carter plays her magnificently, making us feel her seductive blend of calculation and desire, the strangely impacted passion that destroys what it wants in the very act of getting it. Kate Croy is easily the strongest, brainiest, and most contemporary woman character I've seen this year. And it's unnerving to realize that she was created 95 years ago by a man who, even then, was thought to be old-fashioned.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and Rising Tide Entertainment, featuring Delbert McClinton's new release, One of the Fortunate Few, available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, in for Terry Gross. One of the surprise bestsellers of this past summer was a book written by first-time novelist Arundhati Roy. The God of Small Things is about an extended family in India, twin brother and sister, their mother, uncle, and great-aunt.
The mother defies the so-called love laws by having an affair with a man who is not of her caste, an untouchable. That act of rebellion has tragic consequences for the family and provides a way for Roy to explore some powerful taboos in India. The God of Small Things has been released in 29 countries, and last month it received the Booker Prize, England's most prestigious literary award. But while she has received international acclaim, the book has gotten Arundhati Roy in trouble in her own country. An Indian lawyer charged Roy with obscenity and wants the book banned unless the offending passages about this illicit relationship are removed. The case is still pending in the Indian courts. I spoke with Arundhati Roy in August about her novel. We began with a reading from the beginning of the book.
May in Imanam is a hot, brooding month. The days are long and humid. The river shrinks and black crows gorge on bright mangoes in still, dust-green trees. Red bananas ripen. Jackfruits burst. Dissolute bluebottles hum vacuously in the fruity air. Then they stun themselves against clear window panes and die, fatly baffled in the sun. The nights are clear, but suffused with sloth and sullen expectation. But by early June, the southwest monsoon breaks, and there are 3 months of wind and water, with short spells of sharp, glittering sunshine that thrilled children snatched to play with. The countryside turns an immodest green. Boundaries blur as tapioca fences take root and bloom. Brick walls turn moss green. Pepper vines snake up electric poles. Wild creepers burst through laterite banks and spill across the flooded roads. Boats ply in the bazaars, and small fish appear in the puddles that fill the PWD potholes on the highways.
And that's Arundhati Roy reading from the beginning of her book, The God of Small Things. How would you describe what your novel is about? It's a complex story. It moves forward and backward in time. It has a complex cast of characters. How would you distill that story for the audience?
Well, I have to say that that's one thing that I just can't do, because I sort of wage a one-woman war against simplification, you know. And to me, the book is the simplest way of saying what I had to say. So for me, you know, The God of Small Things is really, it isn't the story that matters, you know. It's an ancient story. It's a love story. It's a story about childhood and motherhood and intimacy and transgression. It doesn't matter where it's set. You know, the fact that it's set in India is only because that's where I grew up and that is the territory that I know. But for me, it's a story about biology, about our biological natures.
Well, one of the transgressions in the novel has to do with the love law, and the mother in this story, Amu, falls in love, has a passionate love affair with a man of a different sect, a different caste. She's Christian, he's Hindu. And in your own life, your parents mirrored that same part of the story, as your mother was from a different caste than your father.
Yeah, that's right. My mother married my mother's from Kerala, my father was from Bengal, and she was Christian, he was Hindu. They married, and then they were divorced when I was very young, mm-hmm. and she came back to live in Kerala.
What was the reaction to their marriage? Had they broken the love law, so to speak?
Well, the reaction to their marriage, you know, among the sort of educated upper class, if you do something like that, and if she had remained married to him, I suppose there would not have been terrible consequences, you know. But when she left him, she had to, because of, you know, various private reasons, she comes back into the heart of this traditional community. I mean, not into the heart, actually. She lives on the edge of this traditional community. Mm-hmm. And she has children. And this community then does not allow them the assurances that it would allow, you know, people. It would give people who lived within it. So what you are is, for instance, me and my brother were growing up on the edge of this mm-hmm. community, which meant leading an completely unprotected childhood with a very vulnerable mother as a protector.
Well, I want to have you read a passage from the book, and this is actually from the very end of the book, when Amu, the mother, is making love to this man that is such a transgression. And I should add that a man in India has said that this passage in your book undermines public morality, and you're going to have to go back and face a courtroom to defend what you wrote. But first, I want to have the audience hear your words as you read this passage.
Okay. She unbuttoned her shirt. They stood there, skin to skin, her brownness against his blackness, her softness against his hardness, her nut-brown breasts against his smooth ebony chest. She smelled the river on him, his particular Paravan smell that so disgusted baby Kochuma. Amu put out her tongue and tasted it in the hollow of his throat, on the lobe of his ear. She pulled his head down towards her and kissed his mouth, a cloudy kiss, a kiss that demanded a kiss back. He kissed her back, first cautiously, then urgently. Slowly his arms came up behind her. He stroked her back, very gently. She could feel the skin on his palms, rough, calloused, sandpaper. He was careful not to hurt her. She could feel how soft she felt to him. She could feel herself through him, her skin, the way her body existed only where he touched her. The rest of her was smoke. She felt him shudder against her. His hands were on her haunches, pulling her hips against his to let her know how much he wanted her. Biology designed the dance, terror timed it, dictated the rhythm with which their bodies answered each other, as though they knew already that for each tremor of pleasure, they would pay with an equal measure of pain, as though they knew that how far they went would be measured against how far they would be taken. So they held back, tormented each other, gave of each other slowly. But that only made it worse. It only raised the stakes. It only cost them more, because it smoothed the wrinkles, the fumble and rush of unfamiliar love, and roused them to fever pitch. Behind them, the river pulsed through the darkness, shimmering like wild silk. Yellow bamboo wept.
And that's Arundhati Roy reading from The God of Small Things. I think that's a beautiful passage.
Thank you. Well, other people don't think so.
I know. And I wonder when you wrote that passage, and even when you conceived of the story, if indeed you conceived of it in a conscious kind of way, whether you thought you would get yourself in trouble with the censorship laws in India. Did that cross your mind?
Well, firstly, yeah, I didn't conceive of it consciously. I mean, it's a story that revealed itself to me as I wrote. But there are no censorship laws in terms of actual, you know, laws when you write a book. There are in cinema and television, but not in this. I have to say that, you know, I'm always in trouble in India. So this was something which I didn't know it would be exactly this, but I was not surprised that something happened, you know, because India is a country where there can be no consensus on really important things, you know. It's a country that lives in several centuries simultaneously. And the way I look at it is that it is the fallout of literature. It's the cutting edge, you know. And for me, it's important to argue this case because that is my territory as much as it is the territory of whoever has filed it against me.
But if there are no specific laws, when you go back to India and I assume have to face someone in court, what are you going to defend and on what grounds?
Well, you see, the way it works is that a private citizen has, he's a lawyer, this man, he has filed against a criminal case against me in the lower court. You know, it's a district court. And when the magistrate admitted his case, it becomes like the state of Kerala versus me.
Right.
Okay. Now, I have, and what he's done is he hasn't even bothered to submit the book as evidence. All he did was to photocopy 3 pages and say, isn't this obscene? And he submits it, and the magistrate admitted the case and sent a summons to me. Now, I have appealed in the High Court, and in my petition, I have actually quoted from other judgments. There are liberal judgments about things like this, you know, how do you define obscenity and who is the custodian of public morality? And so I'm just hoping that the High Court will quash this complaint. And if it doesn't, then I'll appeal to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Let me ask you, though, and this is something I'm sure writers like yourself would have to grapple with. If it was found that there was something obscene about this last chapter and you were asked to remove it from the novel, would you do it?
No, I would just withdraw the novel. I would not tamper with it. I mean, I would not have the choice of not removing it and continuing to have it published.
Right.
But I would not publish it with passages removed. You know, I would not allow somebody to tell me what I can write and what I can remove.
Arundhati Roy's novel, The God of Small Things, won the Booker Prize, England's most prestigious literary award, in October. This is Fresh Air. One of South Africa's most popular interviewers is a man who dresses in drag and appears in the persona of an Afrikaner matron named Evita. Evita's interviewees are the political leaders of the new South Africa. Even Nelson Mandela has been interviewed by Evita. Sounds improbable, doesn't it? But Evita, in between her dishy asides, manages to evoke genuinely interesting, often moving stories from her guests about their years in exile or in prison or their hopes for the new South Africa. This has helped sell the idea of democracy to resistant Afrikaners. The character of Evita is the creation of South African satirist Peter Dirk Ace. He spent much of the 70s, 80s, and early 90s satirizing the apartheid regime, and he's found plenty of source material in the new government. Peter Dirk Ace will bring Evita to America this month as part of the Next Wave Festival at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It's the first American appearance of Evita's show, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. Terry Gross spoke with Peter Dirk Ace in 1995 and asked him to describe Evita.
Evita, firstly, is 10 years older than me. She's 60 this year, and I'm only 50, which is always nice to know. She is got brown hair. She's very... She sometimes feels taller than I am. She sometimes feels thinner than I am, and she's got better legs than I have. but she's very inspired by a great love in my life, who is Sophia Loren. And it's not that she's like Sophia Loren, but Sophia Loren's body language and that extraordinary... eternal confidence that Sophia has physically is something I watch all the time. So Evita has got that inner strength physically, so she's quite imposing. She's got quite a lot of makeup on. She's quite well made up. She's, I suppose, a cross between Imelda Marcos, Who's that lady who ran the hotels? Helmsley, the Helmsley lady?
Oh, Leonor Helmsley, yeah.
Yeah, Margaret Thatcher and Minnie Mouse. I suppose she's a combination of all the strong women that have sort of been around the world, except that Evita is very much her own person. And socially, she was born an Afrikaans girl in the Orange Free State, which is one of the provinces of South Africa. Very much a Calvinist background, very similar to mine. She became the wife of a politician, meaning that she probably was stronger than he was, and eventually overpowered him in her public image. And in fact, in the old South Africa, every time I played her and every time she said, I've just spoken to P.W. Botha, the world believed that she had. And the point of my new show with her is that she now says, I've just spoken to Nelson Mandela, and now they believe that she has too.
What is Evita doing interviewing Nelson Mandela and other luminaries of the new South Africa?
Well, in the old South Africa, she was created in 1978 in a newspaper column I was writing. And because of censorship and because of fear, people were not writing about the things that I thought were firstly, very absurd, and secondly, very important to hear about. So I created this wife of a nationalist member of parliament who, in the column once a month, would tell the truth, and nobody stopped us. And then I started doing my one-man show, and she became a flesh-and-blood character with a big pink hat and gloves and handbag and all that. And, of course, when Nelson Mandela became my president, I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was irrelevant. I was redundant. I would now become a gardener and work quietly in the garden and stop all this nonsense. But it seems that the new government is writing as much material for me as the old one did. But in order to make Evita pertinent, I had to take her out of opposition, where she's useless, and get her into bed with the new government. And so this new TV series called Evita's Funny Galore had her speaking to 12 of the top new politicians in South Africa. And it was the most extraordinary, surreal experience of my life because, as you can imagine, interviewing Nelson Mandela while wearing a dress and being treated like Margaret Thatcher was something that is difficult to explain.
Now, is this a non-threatening way for Afrikaners to relate to democracy through this character of Evita? They can identify with her and she's preaching democracy. She's preaching the new South Africa.
They can, but they're also aware that she's preaching it through the hypocrisy of the new South Africa. I mean, Evita, like so many white South Africans, is the first person to say that she'd never supported apartheid. Everybody in South Africa was now part of the struggle, which is part of the political Alzheimer's disease that every country in trauma seems to suffer when they come out of it, like Germany in 45. And I mean, I still have to come to the US and find anybody who voted for Ronald Reagan twice, you know. So I think it's a universal problem. But it's not just Afrikaners. I think many other South Africans who are not Afrikaans and white, who are Afrikaans and black, also identify with Evita and take her as a sort of a talisman in their lives.
Do you think that Evita can ask questions that regular journalists wouldn't ask? For instance, to Nelson Mandela, she said, you've freed all of us, you've freed me of guilt.
Yes, well, the Nelson interview was a very dicey one because Evita's a very bitchy creature, and I made her very one-dimensional. I did not in any way want to embarrass him. I did not want to confuse him with this campery of a man dressed as a woman. I didn't want to trip him up. I mean, I love the man, and the man is too important, a politician, and too precious a human being to trivialize. So Evita behaved herself very much. But there are definitely things that she can say that I can't say.
Like
that
what?
There are first attitudes that she has that I don't have. She still defends the National Party. She still pretends that apartheid was imported from the United Kingdom and that the Afrikaners gave it the name, but it's that it's a British thing. She's a devil's advocate. And also, because she doesn't exist, means that everybody else can have a ball knowing that they don't exist in that moment in time. So I give people rope and they hang themselves with a smile.
Peter Dirk Ace is my guest. He's a South African satirist. And he hosts a very popular TV show in South Africa in which he dresses in drag as an upper-class Afrikaner matron named Evita. And in that persona, he interviews Nelson Mandela and other leaders of the new South Africa. I understand Nelson Mandela once invited Evita to an election rally. Did Evita go? And what was it like?
Well, that was my first step into the new the new arena, I was asked to come and entertain 40,000 black, mainly black kids and young people from the townships at a rally that Nelson was giving in the Cape. And I took Evita wearing her traditional Africana outfit. It was like doing Fiddle on the Roof in Nuremberg. It was the most extraordinary experience, I'll tell you. I was very nervous because I really didn't know if these people knew what I was doing, because I was very much a white icon through a white media of television and theatre, which was not something that all black people were interested in. And yet, the moment Evita arrived on stage, she was cheered like you would cheer somebody at a basketball game. So I did my 15 minutes, and basically my message to the people was, the vote is secret. No matter who you vote for, nobody will know, because the big fear was that people would be punished for whoever they voted for. And then Nelson arrived, and I was asked to remain there as Evita. I wanted to go to the loo. I needed to go and have a wee. I mean, I'd been dressed as a girl for long enough. I needed to do something boyish. But they said, no, sit. Nelson wants to meet you. So eventually I ended up sitting next to Nelson, gazing at him like Nancy Reagan. And it was wonderful. And every time he looked at Evita, he roared with laughter. And if there's any contribution I can make to the health and the happiness of Nelson Mandela, is to allow him to laugh as much as he likes at Evita. If that's all I'm there for, then I've done my job.
Well, would you do Evita's voice for us to give our listeners a sense of the character?
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you have a chance to talk to the Americans who have done so much to inspire us in the past. You know, I came to America in the 50s with my husband. We were sent to America by Dr. Verwoerd to study your Indian reservation system on which we based our homeland's policy. So I have a very soft spot for you Americans. So there she is.
At the end of the show, Evita sometimes blows kisses to the audiences.
Oh, absolutely. She blows kisses to Nelson Mandela in her cell phone. She speaks to him all the time and tells him to put in his eye drops. She says, now remember, Madiba, it's 2 eye drops every 4 hours, not 4 every 2. Otherwise, your eyes go blue. We don't want a black president with blue eyes.
More from Peter Dirkes in 1 minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Peter Dirkes.
Have you done satires of Winnie Mandela?
I've done her for some years. In fact, I even did her in an airport lounge when she sat next to me and she said, darling, do that sketch you do about me. And let me tell you, it was very hard, except she laughed. I'd never understood why she laughed, but she thought it was funny. Yes, I do Winnie. I do Winnie.
What are some of the things you have to say about her?
Well, Winnie's the one who gave me the title for the new show. At one stage, she says, she's got this fantastic Afro outfit on, and she says, do you like my new outfit? I got it in New York when I was there raising money for the IDP. The shop gave it to me free after I took it. Oh, come now, darling, fair is fair. We watched whites bankrupt our country. Now it's going to be our 10. Baby, you ANC nothing yet. So she's a very sexy, dangerous lady to play with. And she's a major South African politician. So absolutely, she's very much in my show.
You know, you mentioned Desmond Tutu. I understand you do a very good caricature of him.
Thank you, yes. Yes, you know, I said to Peter Dirkes, I said, why am I not in your show? And so he did me in his show, and I went to look at him, and, you know, I said, you know, it's very good, you're very naughty, but you don't wear enough rings on your fingers.
Did he really say that to you?
He said that to me, and he gave me some more rings, and I've got at least 12 rings on my 10 fingers. I love him. I love him. He's a great man.
Now, I've read that in one of your plays, during the era when a lot of your work was being censored, you made up an obscenity, a fake word.
Yes.
That you used as an obscenity. What? And then you called, I think, the censorship board and invited them out to watch your play.
Well, that happened because one of the great things that happened to me is I had a great father, great sense of humor, a very strict Calvinist conservative man, but a man with a great sense of humor. And I got him onto the censor board right in the middle of all my trouble with the censor board. My pa became a censor. Because he could see movies free. He loved the idea of seeing movies uncut and free. And he's the one who said, these people are such idiots. Learn the law. Learn the law and trap them with their own law. So the law says that if they have one complaint, they must come and ban. So I used to complain. I used to send them 3 or 4 different letters with different letterheads and different pens complaining about my work. So they would come and ban my work, and I would reproduce the letters and say I was responsible for my own censorship, and then that would get great publicity. So sadly, I frightened them away. But then in one play, instead of using really rude words, I made up Afrikaans words to sound rude, and they banned that play. The publicity was more than money could buy, and that made the people laugh at the fear of censorship, and that was also very positively undermining of the system.
What are the words that you made up, the fake Afrikaner swear words?
Well, there's a word that sounds like this, genotskrots. Doesn't it sound rude? Genotskrots. I mean, it sounds like something like a crotch that gives joy, which, of course, it doesn't mean a thing, but it's genotskrots. It was wonderful. And they had to look it up in their dictionary, and they couldn't find it, and they were very embarrassed.
So this was like a little performance piece you created, in a way.
Yes. I mean, you know, everything was part of the whole. Everything meant that no matter, even if you were... If you knew you were breaking the law, you had to make them aware of the fact that you knew that you were breaking the law. In some of my shows, I would have a pre-printed postcard addressed to the Minister of the Interior, in which the postcard said, I hereby find this show obscene, blasphemous, blah, 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 delete whichever word is not applicable. And they would just post these in their thousands to the minister and just clog his postal passages and cause unnecessary chaos and hope. Hopefully put up the blood pressure and made people laugh at their bosses. Laughter is a great weapon. You know, people find it very hard to fight it.
Peter Dirk Ace's show, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, makes its American debut this weekend at the Brooklyn Academy of Music as part of the Next Wave Festival. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1995. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY. This is NPR, National Public Radio.